General Charles Gordon, also known in Sudan as Gordon Pasha and the Mahdi. The most extraordinary example of the clash of cultures and religions in Sudan came in the latter half of the 19th century. The legacy of the English Christian general, General Charles Gordon, or Gordon Pasha, as he's remembered in Sudan, and of the Arab Muslim Mahdi, Muhammad Ibn Abdullah, continues to influence Sudan to this day and influence our mission work there. Charles Gordon, whose life and death was destined to have such a great impact upon the history of Sudan, was born in England in 1833. The fourth son of a Royal Artillery officer, he rose to become a Lieutenant General in the British Army. Charles was described as a resourceful and aggressive youngster with a keen eye and a fiery temper for injustice. At 16, he entered the military academy and at 19 began training for the Royal Engineers, an elite professional corps. It was the engineers who carried out reconnaissance work, led storming parties, demolished obstacles in assaults, carried out rearguard actions and retreats and other hazardous tasks. Gordon first saw action in the Crimean War, 1850s, in Russia, where he gained a reputation for fearless scouting of enemy positions under fire in the front line, always returning with accurate field sketches and useful intelligence. Gordon was critical of the general lack of offensive spirit, and he is disgusted by those whose zeal was less than his. He wrote of the indescribable excitement of war and how he enjoyed it amazingly. He was mentioned in dispatches. Now, in a whole army, when an individual is mentioned in dispatch, that was pretty much the highest honor imaginable, along with getting medals. After the Crimean War, Gordon was appointed assistant commissioner to an international commission to survey the new Russian-Turkish boundary. And for 3 years, this preoccupied him in Bessarabia and in Armenia. Thereafter, Captain Gordon was sent to China, where he reconnoitred 400 miles of the Great Wall. He also began a charitable fund for paupers, the poor, contracted smallpox, and began to seriously consider eternal things. At about this time, Tin Wang, or the Heavenly King, as he called himself, inaugurated a new dynasty of perpetual peace by starting a vicious civil war. What better way to start eternal peace than have a civil war? Hundreds of thousands died at the hands of these Taiping rebels, many of whom were being beheaded, crucified, or buried alive by these Wangs. Yet these so-called freedom fighters received widespread support from British liberals, with some writing ecstatic accounts of sober, God-fearing Wangs, which is what the Taiping rebel leaders were called. Well, in 1863, Major Gordon was appointed commander of the Chinese mercenary force, which had been optimistically named the Ever Victorious Army, the EVA. Well, he made it so. He took to the task of suppressing the extraordinarily successful Taiping rebels with ingenuity. The Taiping rebels were winning the war. In fact, they'd taken a vast amount of territory, which stretched all the way over to Nanking and Shanghai. Huge swathes of territory of Chinese Empire the Taiping rebels had conquered. Well, General Gordon, he is then Major Gordon, turned the enemy's two greatest assets to his own advantage. Because the Taipings were better fighters than his own Chinese troops, he spared the prisoners' lives and enlisted captured Taiping into his ever-victorious army. The many intricate waterways which serve as obstacles to advances, Gordon turned into routes for supply and attack. He utilized a large flotilla of small ships to transport his artillery and his infantry down the canals to outflank the Taipings and bring his guns to bear from positions they had not expected. Gordon conceived it to be the duty of a commanding officer to personally lead critical assaults. This he did with calm courage and competence. In 16 months, he planned and executed 16 major offensives, capturing or destroying most of the Taipings and the weaponry. And here you see him walking in front with a cane, which is not unusual in the 19th century. British officers thought going in the front with a cane to lead the men, showing absolute disdain for enemy fire and no concern for your personal safety, was considered the way officers were to behave. Amidst the battles, he rescued many an orphan, and at the height of the Kaisun battle, he was seen carrying a child who, Educated at his protector's expense, grew up to become a senior police officer in Shanghai. Gordon succeeded in defeating the Taiping Rebellion by aggressive leadership and indirect tactics with little loss to his own forces. He earned the reputation of being extraordinarily tough, working day and night, a man of courage, resolution, and when necessary, ruthlessness. He ended up as a marshal in the Imperial Chinese Army, but refused literally a room full of gold. We're talking about a big room. Piled high with gold, the emperor offered it to him as a reward for saving his empire. And he flatly refused. He said he needed no reward beyond his regular payments as a British soldier. And he returned in 1865 to England as a celebrity, lionized by the press as Chinese Gordon. To the end of his days, people would call him Chinese Gordon. And of course, he wasn't Chinese, but he had made his name in China. His father's death in the year of his return to England revived his spiritual interests. And it's from 1865 that he dated his true conversion to Christ. Before this, he wrote that he had a belief that Jesus is the Son of God, and he used to have feelings of deep depression on account of my faults. Now I know Jesus is my Savior. God made me count the cost and conclude that his service should be all. The fruits of the Spirit should be had only by abiding in Christ. Now Gordon gave himself wholeheartedly to Christian service in his community, visiting poor families, sick people, lonely people whom he befriended. For the rest of his life, he is involved in the relief of the sick, the suffering, the poor, and particularly the homeless orphans. His family mansion became a mission house. He ran a free school from his home where every evening he taught reading, writing, arithmetic, and history. There was also cricket, chess, and cheerful hymns. The scuttlers from the slums normally arrived filthy and were washed by Colonel Gordon. Planting the fresh, cleaned, clothed boy in front of a mirror, Gordon would say, "Just as you now see a new boy on the outside, I want you to be new on the inside as well." Gordon gave them a home, food, clothes, teaching, and a knowledge of God and his word, and he also helped them find employment. After 8 years of such inner-city missionary activity in England, and of course he was doing military work on the side too, like improving the defences of the Thames and so on. He was an engineer. Gordon was invited to replace Samuel Baker as governor of Equatoria, the southernmost province of Sudan. Now, his mission would be to establish order and suppress the slave trade in over 200,000 square miles of thorn, shrub and swamp. Now, bear in mind, Equatoria was not under British control. It was under Egyptian control. Sudan was not a British colony. Sudan was an Egyptian colony. But Britain had financial dealings with Egypt, primarily to do with the Suez Canal, which was essential to Britain's connectivity to the Indian Ocean and the Indian Empire and so on. And so they loaned out their officers to assist allies, in this case, the Khedive of Egypt, which meant that they ended up in strange places like Sudan, where the British were not colonists. They weren't running part of the empire there. It was more like assisting, but of course, to end the slave trade. Like Moses, who despised the riches of Egypt, Gordon refused the £10,000 a year which the Khedive of Egypt offered him. And he said, "I'll accept only £2,000 a year. I don't need any more." And this contributed to the growing belief that Chinese Gordon was not quite sane. Who turns down a room full of gold and accepts just 20% of the salary offered him? One caravan with 3,000 proceeding from the coast in East Africa lost 2/3 of their number from starvation, disease, murder in the Nubian desert. One slave caravan of 2,000 slaves literally vanished. Every single slave died crossing this desert. So the conditions were hideous. And this is what Gordon was going to end. Sudan at that time was a colony of Egypt, which in turn owed allegiance to the Ottoman Turkish Empire. Officially, it was under the Turkish Empire. But the Turkish Empire was falling apart and Britain was moving in. The Khedive Ismail, who is an Albanian Muslim, ruled Egypt, and he himself owned a lot of slaves on a gigantic scale, as did most of his relatives, friends, ministers of state. Slavery was legal. But this was bad for the image in Europe. And so most of his investments came from Europe, like the Suez Canal, building up Alexandria and Port Said and so on. So Ismail instructed General Gordon to stop the slave trade in Sudan, which was total public relations operation, not like he really cared. And thus the Khedive could continue to enjoy the services of innumerable slaves in Egypt and at the same time earn a reputation as an enlightened leader opposed to the slave trade and get lots of investments. As governor of Equatoria, Gordon soon learned that almost all of his Egyptian soldiers had been sent to Sudan as a punishment. He had no volunteers. It's not like anyone there wanted to be there. They were highly unmotivated. Stunningly unmotivated, these Egyptian troops, ill-clothed, ill-fed, unpaid conscripts, were never allowed to leave lest they desert, so they were never allowed to go home on leave because nobody believed they'd come back. Why would they? Yet with such unpromising troops, Gordon would suppress the slave trade, explore the Great Lakes, meaning Lake Victoria and all the others around there, and introduced law and order to Equatoria. The possession of slaves in Egyptian-ruled Sudan was still legal at that time. It was the traffic in slaves that Gordon had to suppress, and slavery was easy money. Adventurers could obtain loans, boats, slave raiders in Khartoum, sail up the Nile River, and, in partnership with some cooperative chief, the slavers would raid a few villages at dawn. A few people would be shot or speared, the rest would be captured, the elders would be tortured to reveal where their ivory or any other precious things had been hidden. Adults were secured with a sisba, or a heavy forked pole, resting on the shoulders, the head secured by a crossbar, hands tied to the pole. Of the survivors who reached Khartoum, females were allotted to be concubines or domestic servants. Most of the males became farm laborers or house servants. The lucky men became bazingas, or slave soldiers, to carry out slave raids on others. The unlucky males were castrated for household service as eunuchs. And this operation, performed in unsanitary conditions without anesthetics, was often fatal. In fact, they said something like 80% died, but you know, the 20% survived. They were wanted for house servants. The byproducts of the slave trade were cattle and ivory, captured or bartered, which were carried by the slaves. So the slaves got a certain amount of money, but the ivory they carried back and the cattle they herd back, that was where the real money was. The average slaver could aim on capturing 400 to 500 slaves worth £5 or £6 each, 20,000 pounds of ivory worth £4,000 in Khartoum a year. So basically, obviously, the ivory was the big money spinner. The slaves were basically helpful for transporting the ivory when you get down to it. The thriving, stinking, fly-swarming city of Khartoum prospered in the twin trades of slaves and ivory. There was hardly an official in Sudan who was not involved in these trades. It would have been hard to find a household in Khartoum so poor so as not to own at least one slave. Even the poorest homes had a slave. And even the most pious and humane Muslims were unable to see why the Christians made such a fuss about slavery. I mean, what's so bad about slavery? It might be wrong to enslave Muslims, went the argument, but the economics of Sudan requires a constant flow of fresh slaves, and the vast majority of these were pagan blacks. Could any reasonable man deny that the life of a Negro as a slave in Egypt or Turkey or Syria was infinitely preferable to his life in Equatoria or the Congo, which was poor, nasty, brutish, and short? And so went the common rationalizations in defense of the Islamic slave trade. And it seemed only the Christian Europeans thought slavery was a bad idea. The rest of the world said, what are you making such a fuss about? Gordon's first action against the slave trade was to nationalize the ivory trade, which denied the slavers much of their profit. Then he closed the Nile River to slavers. This, unfortunately, had the unforeseen result of immeasurably increasing the sufferings of the slaves, because instead of now being crammed like sardines into boats down the Nile, the slaves are now marched across the pitiless desert. Far greater suffering, far more deaths. Gordon now improved communications down the Nile River, multiplied military outposts throughout Equatoria, and set about introducing the rule of law. Now, it was a very personal administration. Justice was swift. Criminals were flogged. That means whipped. It was effective. It was popular with the people. They saw justice coming. However, it only worked because of General Gordon's impartiality. With anyone less fair and less conscientious, it would have been abused, without doubt. Gordon's was the first example of a foreign rule which could be fair, conscientious, and incorruptible. If there's one thing you can say about General Gordon, he was completely incorruptible. He could not be bought. He did not have a price. and he frustrates the life out of all these characters who thought every man's got a price. At Redjol, over 100 armed men of the Nyam Nyam tribe, who are reportedly occasionally cannibals, surrounded Gordon, and after drumming all night, advancing threateningly on him, General Gordon drew two guns and ordered them now go. And they went, and they left him alone. On another occasion, a mob of hostile Bari men threatened Gordon, and as the witch doctor seemed to be performing some cursing ceremony on him, sort of like the All Blacks, Maori, New Zealand, Haka type routine, we're going to eat you kind of thing, Gordon fired a shot on the ground beside them, and this ended the ceremony and it ended the threat. Gradually, movement became easier in Equatoria. People began to see that they could actually receive justice even against the governor's own servants. When Gordon began his work in Equatoria, its only exports were ivory and slaves. Slavers operated with impunity. A healthy young woman could be purchased from her parents for a packet of needles. By the time Gordon left, a respect for human life had once again returned to Equatoria, if it ever was there in the first place. Certainly could say it was being introduced for the first time. As slave routes had now moved across the desert to Bahr el Ghazal, Gordon wrote to the Khedive of Egypt requesting the position of Governor General of the whole of Sudan, and this was granted. I mean, who wanted Bahr el Ghazal? Who wanted Sudan? Nothing but trouble. You wanted, you're welcome. Gordon's Sudan was 1,640 miles long and about 660 miles wide. His first task as Governor General was to see the whole of Sudan and to be seen by it. Within 5 months, Gordon rode over 5,000 miles, that's 8,000 kilometers, which, by the way, is the distance we drive one way, going from Cape Town through the roads to get up to our mission base in Mundri in Sudan. 8,000 kilometers by camel. Across scorching desert sand, stony steppes, wooded uplands, and steamy swamps. It goes from Sahara Desert in the north down to equatorial rainforest in the very south, especially adjacent to the Congo, around, for example, Yambio, that is an equatorial rainforest. He used thoroughbred racing camels capable of long journeys at an average of 7 miles an hour. That's pretty impressive. He owned a team of 5 camels so as not to wear them out, and he read books while riding at a trot, redeeming the time. Sort of like John Wesley would read books while riding on his horse, and his horse somehow knew the way, and he could devour books while riding. The desert strengthened the tendencies towards asceticism and mysticism, which were really very strong within him. As others before him had been prepared for their life work in the desert, think of Moses, think of Jesus, so too Gordon became even more spiritually attuned. Gordon enjoyed the drama of swooping down like an avenging angel upon a lethargic garrison of a remote desert outpost, leaning forward in the high saddle, legs pressed in on the camel shoulders as he is depicted in this famous statue later erected in Khartoum. During this camel tour of Sudan, Gordon suppressed a revolt, and the robber chieftains of Bahr el Ghazal cowered into submission. He neutralized the largest, most dangerous slave trader, Suleiman Zabir, disbanded half a slave army, took the rest into his army, all without firing a shot. He could walk into a slave trader's camp and without even drawing his sword or his pistol would manage to subdue and turn the enemy onto his side. Just imagine the force of personality to do that. Gordon succeeded in breaking the back of the slave trade in Sudan with prayer, pressure, persuasion, and his overwhelming personality. These experiences convinced him that there was no limits to what he could achieve by audacity and faith in God. This is a man whose life text was, God has not given me a spirit of fear. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. In his writings, Gordon rebuked Christians for lacking in self-denial and devotion. A man must give up everything, understand everything for Christ. Gordon was ruthless with incompetent officials. He sacked many lethargic and corrupt officials, and that was like most of them. He created momentous upheavals and disruptions in the administrations. When he investigated the prisons, he found them dens of injustice with many prisoners detained for years without having come to trial. They hadn't even had the day in court yet. And Gordon somehow found the time to look into every case. Corruption, false testimony and incompetence that led to so many miscarriages of justice, which he endeavored to reverse. He summarily had a notorious murderer hung, and the city was quieter for it. You can imagine, nothing like that sort of thing to make people behave themselves. He had a man hanged for castrating a slave. Many unjustly detained without trial were released. In just 2 months, Gordon captured 12 slave caravans. One of these, after crossing 500 miles of desert, had only 90 out of the original 400 slaves surviving. Few were over 16 years old. Some of the girls had babies and were many small children. He caught many of his own officials and soldiers involved in the slave trade. Gordon ordered that the governor of any district through which a captured slave train was proved to have passed, by that means like slave caravan, should forfeit 3 months' pay. And when a Royal Navy vessel captured a large slave ship offshore of Massawa, Gordon solemnly handed over 3 months of his own salary, showing he counted himself under the same rules he imposed on others. At Chaka, he expelled 100 slave dealers, 4 of whom were proven guilty of a massacre, and they were shot. 14 slaves were rescued from a small party of 3 slavers whom Gordon had flogged. To tighten the blockade of Bahr el Ghazal, Gordon authorized the Baggara tribe to arrest slavers, which they did happily. They got bounty, basically. They were rewarded financially for capturing slave traders. Financial problems in Cairo now precipitated a change in government, and the ousted Khedive Ismail was replaced by Khedive Tewik, a Turk. And this led to Gordon being replaced as Governor General of Sudan. Yet Gordon left behind a transformed Sudan. He had abolished Qubakh, which is the whipping of the soles of the feet for not paying your taxes. Imagine how unpleasant that must be. Stamping out corruption, literally. He had freed many who had been unjustly imprisoned. He had freed many slaves. He had also remitted back taxes and provided pipe water for the first time to Khartoum. He was popular in Equatoria as the man who had at least temporarily freed them from the Muslim North. However, he is resented, although he is respected by the Arab North. His prestige was higher than his popularity. He might not have been popular, but he was respected and feared. Most Sudanese value the courage of a warrior very highly, and Gordon's courage was unquestioned. They might have resented having a Christian govern them, but they respected his piety and his devotion. He's a man of prayer. They might have deplored his attacks on the slave trade, but they appreciated his zeal, his energy, and his integrity. And of course, who can't be happy for cutting taxes? Gordon was admired more for who he was than what he had done. Now, while Gordon was leaving Sudan, another leader was living as a hermit on the island of Aba, 200 miles up the White Nile from Khartoum. In May 1881, at the age of 38, Muhammad Ahmed ibn Abdullah proclaimed himself the Mahdi, which is like the Muslim military messiah. He's like how we describe the Antichrist, but the Muslims see him as their messiah. This was after years spent in prayer, fasting, and Quranic study and contemplation of the decay of Islam. Now, the Sufi sect, which predominated in Sudan, widely believed in the coming of the Mahdi, the expected one, an eschatological figure whose advent would foreshadow the end of the world. The Sufi leaders and teachers, their teachers known as fakers. In fact, that's where the word fake comes from. It's from the teachers of the Sufi sect. Now, if you want to understand Islam, you've got to divide Islam into roughly 3 mega blocks. They've got thousands of sub-cults, but the 3 mega blocks are the Shiite, the Sunni, and the Sufi. Now, the Shiites are much like our Catholics. The important thing is the leader. What does the Ayatollah say? It's like Catholics, Pope. The Sunnis are more like our Protestants, because the important thing is what does the book say? In their case, the Quran. And the Sufis are sort of like our Charismatics. Who cares what anyone says? The important thing is my feelings, my emotions. And so, they're the sword-swallowing, fire-breathing, miracle-a-day type of crowd. And their leaders were known as fakers. And so the term fake has entered the English language because that was the name of a Sufi teacher. Just like luck entered into the English language because the goddess of prosperity in India is Lakshmi. And so the English soldiers started to, as a joke, say good Lakshmi. And good Lakshmi ended up being good luck. And so luck is just a derivation of the Hindu goddess Lakshmi as the goddess of prosperity. Of course, none of us believe in luck, because we don't believe in Lakshmi and we don't believe in Hinduism. But interesting that a fake is in fact, the name of a teacher of the Sufi sect. And the dervishes, you've heard of the whirling dervishes, and maybe you've heard of the gollywogs. This also comes from that, these big hair, and the gollywogs, and some British started to use the term wog in general, and they even had the gollywog in Enid Blyton's Noddy and Big Ears, and the gollywog was the one who's always stealing things. Well, all that comes from Sudan, all that comes from the Mahdi's time. And the Sufi leaders believed that the year 1300, after the Hijra, when Muhammad began his movement to Medina, that was 1882 of the Christian calendar, the Mahdi would reveal himself, sort of like our people saying year 2000 and all that sort of thing. And just a while ago we had, what was 2000 and 2012 was another big one. Yeah. I mean, every religion's got these creeps, but anyway, so this was the big Muslim one. They're all going berserk because the Mahdi was going to arrive and end of the world and all that sort of thing. Exactly, that sort of thing. They were therefore predisposed to accept the claims of Muhammad Ahmad, who was a member of the Samani order of Sufis. He came from the west of the Muslim world, not as had been predicted from the east, but otherwise he's everything that a Mahdi should be. He was devout, he was learned, he is descended from the prophet, apparently. He carried the sign of a mole on his right cheek. What more prophecy do you need than that? And there'd been others claiming to be the Mahdi, but none had come as close as he did to matching the prophecy. So, good enough. As the successor of the prophet Muhammad, the Mahdi claimed temporal authority, that's political authority, over all Muslims, and spiritual authority too. So he's not only a military messiah, he's basically a prophet, he's a khalifa, he's everything, he's the Mahdi. And he can restore the purity of Islam. This is what they think the Mahdi was coming to do. So he had chosen an opportune time to announce his uprising. There was widespread resentment of foreign rule by the Turks. Many thousands had been bankrupted by the suppression of the slave trade, which of course was General Gordon's doing. The Fakirs and Dervishes responded to his religious appeal, and the riverine tribes, the tribes along the river, desired the return of the lucrative slave trade. The Baggara nomads were basically against any government, meaning against any taxes. So when the Mahdi forbade the paying of taxes to Khartoum and announced the return of the slave trade, popularity was assured, he's got everyone's vote, so to speak. And imitating Muhammad, the Mahdi made his Hijra retreat to the Jebel Qadir in the Nuba Mountains of South Kordofan, which we all know about. That's one of our mission's primary mission fields for decades now, is South Kordofan, the Nuba Mountains. And so he retreated to the Nuba Mountains, which is an easily defendable place where any foreign armies can disappear very quickly in all the ambushes. So the Baggara joined him by the thousands. Three punitive expeditions sent by the Khedive of Egypt against the Mahdists were annihilated, and the rebellion flourished because each time all it did was resupply the rebels with a whole lot of great new weapons. Thank you. Meanwhile, there'd been a military coup in Cairo, Egypt, and there was a massacre of Christians in Alexandria. So this led to a British naval bombardment in reprisal and an expedition under Gordon's lifelong military friend, General Wolseley, to protect the Khedive and against his army and the foreigners against the mob. Well, General Wolseley is famous in South Africa. He had a lot to do with the First Anglo-Boer War. He came in to take over from Lord Chelmsford after the chaos that Chelmsford had endured at the Battle of East Lwana. And Wolseley was a very highly respected general. In fact, he rose very high to, at one time, become chief of staff of the entire British Army. But General Wolseley was part of this intervention. So on the 13th of September, 1882, Wolseley routed the Egyptian army at Tel El Kabir. And this began Britain's occupation of Egypt, which was meant to be brief, but it lasted for 7 years. This is typical of governments. You know, we're going to be back by Christmas, just a short thing. How many years have the Americans been playing the fool in Afghanistan and Iraq now? I mean, these are short wars, just a couple of months. And yeah. This is what governments do all the time. Now, during this time, what was General Gordon doing? He was promoted to Major General and appointed Commandant General of the forces in the Cape Colony in South Africa. And so he became Commandant of the Cape of Good Hope. And that was his office. I've been marched up those stairs for commandants before on orders. So that was his office. Those three windows along the side there, that was Major General Gordon's office at the Cape of Good Hope. And this was the seat of military power and government in the Cape colony at the time. And so this was where General Gordon was based. You know, a lot of interesting things happened while he's here, including the Anglo-Zulu War and the Anglo-Boer War, first Anglo-Boer War. Because he is here from 1879, 1881. So he's here for those momentous events. Gordon soon made his strong, unpopular opinions known. The Boers, who had recently thrashed the British army at Majuba, these Boers were men after his own heart, brave, frugal, and pious. It's not exactly what people want the head of their army in the Cape to be saying, that they're on the side of the enemy. And he said, well, the Boers were the victims. We're next their territory. We shouldn't have been in the first place. It's none of our business. And so we should just leave the Transvaal to the Transvaalers. Battle of Majuba had just occurred, and of course the British were really angry about the fact that they'd got thrashed up there, and they'd lost General Colley, who was High Commissioner of the whole of British forces in the whole of Southern Africa, and this was a stunning defeat. And then, in the Anglo-Zulu War, General Gordon says they'd been badly treated, promises being made to them had been broken, the British had drawn first blood. Why'd we invade them anyway? They hadn't attacked us. It's none of our business. We shouldn't be in Zululand. Should give Zululand back to the Zulus. So you can imagine people in the Cape, especially the government, were tearing their hair out over this man who had so many opinions. And he was completely sympathetic to the Boers and the Zulus. In fact, he had gospel tracts specially made up and translated into Dutch, into Zulu, printed and to be distributed to them. And after the British had destroyed the last Zulu impi at the Battle of Ulundi and had taken Keshweo, the king of the Zulus, captive, he was sent to the Cape of Good Hope, and Gordon, as the commandant general, was ordered, put King Keshweo in the dungeon. And he refused. He said, why? He's done nothing wrong. I mean, he's just defending his own country. So King Keshweo was treated as an honored guest and allowed full reign around the castle. And Major General Gordon had evangelistic conversations translated to Zulu with Keshweo, and spoke about spiritual matters and treated him as an honored guest, and organized for him to be sent by ship to England, where he could intercede with the Queen of England, Queen Victoria, to restore Zululand to him, which in fact was done. Neither did Gordon neglect the spiritual welfare of the Boers. He had one of his tracts translated into Dutch, distributed quantities around the countryside for the God-fearing burghers to study. And, of course, by now the British government was just fed up with this man who'd gone native and was totally sympathetic to the Boers and the Zulus. Gordon's primary responsibility was to settle the Basutu border question. And during this time, he had dealings with the incredibly devious Cecil John Rhodes, who found Gordon an extraordinary man, one who was utterly disinterested in money. And Cecil Rhodes is famous for saying every man has his price, but Gordon didn't have a price, and he was not for sale, and he wasn't even for rent. He could not influence this man. Gordon was incorruptible, so obviously Gordon had to go. So finally, Gordon resigned, complaining it's not possible to do anything with such a weak, vacillating government as that in Cape Town, proving that not much has changed over the years. No, well, basically, he officially resigned, but he is actually fired. I mean, he is kicked out. But because his record was so impeccable, they couldn't put it that there was no reason to dismiss Queen Victoria's favorite general. They couldn't do that politically. He was the most famous popular general in the Victorian era. In the 19th century, there's no more popular general amongst the British than General Gordon. So they couldn't actually fire him, but they got him out. Now, at this point, Gordon took long leave, the first of his life, 14 months, and he went to Palestine, to the Holy Land. And he fulfilled his lifelong ambition to spend a year of research in the Holy Land. And today, when you go to Gordon's tomb, well, they call it Gordon's tomb, it's not Gordon's tomb, it's Christ's tomb, but Gordon's the one who identified it. He said it's the happiest year of his life. He had a routine of prayer, Bible study, and examined Jerusalem and historic sites using Bible study and archaeological research to identify the actual tomb of Christ. Now, the place where all the tourists go, meaning all the Catholic and Orthodox tourists go, the place of the Holy Sepulchre, That was identified by a mystic monk who had a dream. And he identified, there it is. And they built all this edifice over it, a superstitious mumbo-jumbo. And it's similarly with Golgotha. They didn't do Bible study and archaeological research. They just had some mystic identify a site by a dream. And then that was it. So the wonderful thing is the real sites were left for General Gordon to identify. And so the Protestants go to a nice untouched garden tomb, which hasn't been spoiled by centuries of religious mumbo-jumbo. He set out to resolve through investigation the site of the crucifixion, Golgotha, and the place of the Holy Sepulchre, the empty tomb. In fact, you can see in the book here, it looks like a skull, Golgotha, which he identified. But, you know, he's walking around observant, not expecting some mystical revelations. And he resolved a whole lot. His book, Reflections in Palestine, was to him his most prized achievement. Not his victories in China, wars in Crimea, his achievements in ending slave trade, and to him, his book, Reflections in Palestine, was his greatest lifelong achievement. Well, on the 8th of September, 1883, a British Colonel Hicks, in command of an Egyptian force of 10,000 unmotivated soldiers, so the British hired out their men as mercenaries effectively, but it was influence, just like American soldiers are all over the world now, sort of advising different governments, but they're obviously serving the interests of their government too. So the British were like the biggest mercenary providing force on earth, and they were providing soldiers for everyone from China through to Japan and Turkish Empire as well. Well, Colonel Hicks marched into Kordofan, meaning the Nuba Mountains, in search of the Mahdi. And on the 5th of December, 1883, his rabble was annihilated along with himself and all his officers. And this military disaster placed Khartoum itself at risk. And while some of the men fought bravely, the fact is they had just resupplied the Mahdi with 10,000 modern rifles and vast amounts of ammunition, artillery, monumentally increasing the threat. Now, as Britain was occupying Egypt, it was now responsible for Sudan. Now, remember, Sudan is not Britain's colony. Sudan is Egypt's colony. But Britain has taken over Egypt to safeguard the Suez Canal, so now they've got lumbered with Sudan. They don't want it, but they've got it. However, after Britain's humiliating defeats at the hands of the Zulus at Isandlwana, 1879, and by the Boers at Majuba, 1881, the Liberal government wanted to get out of Egypt and stay out of Sudan. And Majuba's fresh in their minds. It hasn't happened that long ago, just 1881. Here we are in 1883. So unwilling to send an army to relieve Khartoum, the Prime Minister, William Gladstone, agreed to send General Gordon. Now, this is just typical political nonsense. You know, they had to do something, so they're looking for a symbolic gesture. And as Gordon said, so when the Mahdi floats my headless body down the Nile, you can say, well, we did what we could. We sent Gordon. And Gladstone apparently said precisely. So Gordon knew what he was being sent to do. He knew he was being betrayed. He knew he was being sent on an errand that the government had no intention of him succeeding. It was just for them to say, oh, well, you know, we did something. A total of 21,000 Egyptian and Sudanese soldiers were scattered throughout Sudan. They were confronted by 300,000 dervishes or Mahdist rebels, armed with modern rifles and artillery captured from Hicks. Thank you very much. So without a British army, he was given precisely one soldier, one Colonel Stewart as his aide-de-camp. So he went there without a British army. He has got one soldier, and then whatever unmotivated Egyptian and Sudanese forces just happened to be there. I mean, what hope is he of doing anything? It was impossible that Gordon could have put down such a vastly superior force as that led by the Mahdi. Yet General Gordon felt duty-bound to rally to the support of Sudan at the time of crisis. He had invested years in fighting the slave trade there. He was convinced he had to do something. Appointed Governor-General of Sudan, ordered to evacuate all foreigners, Gordon arrived to an enthusiastic welcome in Khartoum. He immediately halved all taxes, abolished tax arrears, made a bonfire of tax records, how to win friends and influence people, super popular. He announced the independence of Sudan from Egypt, appointed a council to rule under himself as commissioner of Her Majesty's government, and then sought to have Britain declare Sudan its protectorate. Now, he had no authority to do any of this, but this is typical General Gordon. As Gladstone says, he treats a military order like a suggestion. He served the King of Kings first and foremost. And he was loyal to the Queen, but he felt nothing for the British government because he knew they were a bunch of backstabbing, conniving politicians. So he then sought to have Britain take Sudan on as a protectorate. Well, surrounded by the Mahdi's forces, he reported an evacuation was impossible, so he requests a relief column, effectively holding the British government to ransom. But once their land routes were cut off and when the telegraph was cut, Gordon stopped being a politician and now concentrated on being a soldier, particularly an engineer. He brought immense reserves of courage and determination and invention into improving the defences of Khartoum. He was negotiating with the Mahdi by letter. He strengthened the fortifications of Khartoum with a ditch. Now, Khartoum lies where the White and the Blue Nile meet. The Blue Nile comes from the mountains of Abyssinia, what now is called Ethiopia, and the White Nile comes from what we'd call Uganda, the Great Lakes, especially Lake Victoria. And so it meets at Khartoum. So he's got the river on two sides, and he draws a ditch, digs a ditch between the two, floods it, and makes effectively Khartoum an island. Brilliant engineering move. He then put landmines, wire entanglements, all sorts of things. He abolished customs duties and pass system at the gates of Khartoum to encourage villagers to bring more produce into market, which they did. They're going to need food to survive a siege. Gordon converted the steamships into armored warships with cannon and used these steamers for sorties to break up enemy concentrations by artillery barrage from the river, also for raids to capture cattle and excursions to buy grain. Where they could, they bought grain. Where they couldn't, they raided cattle from the Mahdi's forces. And during all this time, a groundswell of public outrage was brewing in Britain. Newspaper editorials denounced the government's indecisiveness, evasiveness, and dishonesty. Again, governments in London haven't changed much in the last 100 and something years, have they? Gordon's defense was active, imaginative, aggressive. He himself engaged with sharpshooting to take out enemy snipers. And as the siege tightened, artillery duels were fought. The Times called for prayers for General Gordon in imminent peril at Khartoum. Even Queen Victoria added a voice to the public demand for the British government to send a relief column, which the government did not want to do. And so when the Queen said, "You must send a relief column," they finally were forced to send a relief column. Now, the outcry was perhaps motivated by humanitarian concern. All these people who are definitely going to get massacred. The Mahdi said when he takes Khartoum, he'll kill everyone. Man, woman, child, Muslim, Christian, doesn't matter. He's going to kill everyone. Which is standard if a city refuses surrender and it resists the siege. Standard practice was you kill everyone who is there. There was also commercial interests, of course, trade with Sudan, admiration for General Gordon's courage and dedication to duty. There was hatred of the slave trade, which was very intense in Britain, probably one of the biggest single political factors of the 19th century was Britain's hostility to slave trade. In fact, the Royal Navy versus the slave trade is one book we had dealings with, enforcing abolition at sea. Britain was, after the time of William Wilberforce, sold out as the most anti-slavery campaigning country on the planet. And there was national pride, offended by being defeated by the dervishes. And then, of course, there's evangelical missionary fervor. There's a lot of people keen to follow General Gordon's example and his challenge to evangelize Equatoria. Finally, the British government felt compelled to send a relief column under General Wolseley, the best person for the job, actually, and a personal friend of Gordon, so that was excellent. But he is under serious restrictions, which unnecessarily delayed their progress. He had to acclimatize his troops at each stage on the way and so on. Incredibly, several hundred of the Mahdi soldiers deserted and came over to join Gordon's starving besieged garrison, which is incredible. The British relief column smashed the Mahdi's forces of 10,000 dervishes at the Battle of Abu Klea, and I think there were only 800 British Camel Corps in this column. 800 men defeated 10,000 dervishes at the Battle of Abu Klea, 17th of January, 1885. Now, interestingly, they made a film on this called The Four Feathers, in which it was not Camel Corps. There was cavalry and there was infantry at Abu Klea, and they got totally defeated, smashed, and scattered by the dervishes, which is a complete rewriting of history. But everything in The Four Feathers was historically inaccurate, such as having cavalry officers commanding infantry and then suddenly becoming Camel Corps and then going back to infantry and then commanding cavalry. It's like, no. Just like in Pearl Harbor film, where they suddenly have fighter pilots suddenly flying for the Navy bomber planes off aircraft carriers. No, no, no. You're either in the Naval Air Corps or you're in the Army Air Corps, and you're either a bomber pilot or a fighter pilot. You don't get people switching between bomber and fighter. And these are things which Hollywood does pathetic. But The Four Feathers must be one of the most ahistoric films made on Sedan ever. You were going to ask a question?
I'm just curious how they managed
to. Simple. They formed a square. So as the 800 men saw this massive force coming towards them, they formed a square using the camels also as they had the camels lie down. They formed a full square and they broke the dervish. It was actually a cavalry charge by the classic square, which is, you know, goes back to Wellington and Battle of Waterloo and all this. So the only way is a compact square. Now, if Lord Chelmsford had done this at Isandlwana, they may have survived. But he was spread out over the entire countryside and the Zulus just swept over them, wiped them all out. The only way you can beat an overwhelmingly larger number is to compact, which is like what was done at the Battle of Thermopylae, where the 300 Spartans chose a narrow, narrow pathway in the mountains, and they could hold up hundreds of thousands of Persians because they could only they could only get a few hundred at a time up in that narrow pass. So that's the only way you beat such an overwhelming majority. You've got to go compact. Rorke's Drift, another example. They basically contracted to the size of a tennis court at Rorke's Drift. And that's why on the same day that an entire British regiment, 1,600 men, got wiped out at Isandlwana, just 130 British soldiers beat a force of 5,000 Zulus at Rorke's Drift. Why? They weren't arrogant. They didn't spread out like Lord Chelmsford. They compacted into an effective square. That's the answer to that one. Now, this is 17th of January, 1885, and this caused much fear in the Mahdi's camp because here's a British relief column very close. Just after midnight on 26th January, 1885, over 60,000 dervishes attacked Khartoum, swarming over the defences, overwhelming the thin line of weakened troops who were dying of starvation. They were very weakened. They'd run out of food. It was a bad situation. The Mahdists poured into Khartoum. Now, General Gordon had withstood a siege for over a year already. So at that, they'd really used up all their food supplies. And the British could have gotten a relief column there earlier. Well, the Mahdi slaughtered both soldiers and unarmed civilians, indiscriminately killed everybody, Muslim, Christian, young, old, the lot. There are two main accounts of Gordon's death. The first account to reach Cairo by one who never claimed to be an eyewitness. He wasn't there. He described Gordon calmly and unresistingly being speared to death at the head of the stairs, which is the first version to be published, and it's been immortalized in his famous painting, so it's been generally accepted and is what they put in the Khartoum film played by General by Charlton Heston. However, we have two key eyewitness accounts, one by a bodyguard of Gordon, another by a dervish warrior, who both agreed Gordon went down fighting. As the Mahdists broke into the governor's palace garden, Gordon stopped them in their tracks with revolver fire from upstairs. As he ran out of rounds, he rushed to a wounded man's aid, was hit in the shoulder by a spear. The enemy came on again. He fired again until he ran out of ammunition and then lunged at them with a sword. A dervish shot him in the chest, knocking him back against the wall. He recovered again and with a sword beat back the enemy down the stairs. And at this point, he is felled with a spear thrust to his right side. Now, the reader can take his choice. The unresisting Gordon might accord with contemporary pacifist notions of a martyr. But all his life, Gordon had been a fighter. And the weight of evidence is he died not like a lamb, but like a lion. And that may not be the way that people want to remember him, but the fact is he went down fighting. 2 days later, the British relief column arrived in Khartoum. The British public reacted with rage. The Queen sent a furious telegram chastising her Prime Minister. This is a cartoon in the Times of London at the time, and the headline was, "Too late." Britain arrives too late. This is a photograph of the memorial service taken at the Governor's Palace by the British forces who reached there. These are the ones who had fought at Aberclay. Briefly, it was considered whether to press on and re-establish British prestige and the slave trade and so on. But William Gladstone's liberal views and his innate pacifism reasserts itself, and all British troops were withdrawn from Sudan. They reached Khartoum 2 days late, and then they withdrew. 6 months after Gordon's death, the Mahdi died. In fact, Gordon had predicted, he said, "I may die from your magic, but you will certainly die from mine." A succession of poor harvests, epidemics, tribal wars reduced Sudan to misery. An attempted invasion of Egypt by the Mahdists in 1891 was soundly defeated. Very foolish of them to even think they could have succeeded. Well, in due course, change of government, with a conservative government in power in England, the time was chosen to avenge Gordon. Under General Kitchener, a vast Anglo-Egyptian army advanced up the Nile, always within artillery support of the ships, and building a railway as they advanced. Very slowly, so they had full supplies and had artillery support by the river, and they had a railway coming up behind them. So they took their time, but they crushed the Mahdist army outside Omdurman, one of the greatest battles in history of Africa. Colossal battle. The best depiction of it by film is in the young Winston. Interesting, Winston Churchill was there as a journalist and observed this, the last great cavalry charge of the British cavalry, where they literally had a divisional cavalry charge. Thousands of cavalry charged the dervishes and actually nearly got themselves wiped out because they did not realize that in one of these depressions there was an entire dervish army waiting to ambush them. Nevertheless, spectacular cavalry charge, even though it wasn't that successful. It was a colossal battle, but with the artillery support, they absolutely slaughtered the dervishes. And that was the end of the Mahdist rebellion. By the way, you can see the dervishes here. One of the sort of effective uniforms was they put these black patches were sewn onto their white outfits. So these black rectangular patches sewn on was effectively their uniform. And I don't know, but it distinguished them from everyone else. I think that's the closest thing to uniform they had. So this is a spectacular battle of Omdurman. Omdurman's just north of Khartoum, so it's before the Nile is met by the White and Blue Nile. And so Omdurman is now a massive town, but at that stage it was just a big open area. And here's an actual photograph of part of the battle. And you can see the cavalry have dismounted and they are lined up with their rifles ready to fire. And those are dervishes coming towards them, about to get themselves wiped out. There's just some of the artistic depictions of the Battle of Omdurman. Again, the very best depiction I've ever seen by film is in Young Winston. Just a small part of the film, but they must have expended millions on a spectacular battle. Sudan was then ruled as an Anglo-Egyptian condominium, 1898 through to 1955. The only 57 years of uncorrupt government Sudan ever had. On the whole, Sudan was the most successful and the most altruistic of all Britain's colonial ventures, from which Britain gained very little. Actually, Britain gained zero, but from which the Sudanese people benefited a great deal. Britain never went into Sudan to make it a colony. They only went in to make it a protectorate. They didn't want to go in. They knew that this place is nothing but bad news. But, you know, they sent the best there. The best of the best of the civil service and the military. And it was considered an honor to go to Sudan, even though it was one of the worst places on earth to go in terms of climate, distance, and so on. And the Gordon Memorial Mission was established. And it was under the Gordon Memorial Mission that missionaries such as Dr. Kenneth Fraser went and established the mission in Mundi, which is where our mission's got its base up in Sudan. So Sudan, if anyone talks about being a British colony, they're wrong. It was an Egyptian colony and became a British protectorate.
Why, some time ago, no one wanted to go there, but now suddenly it's an honor to go there?
Oh, well, it was considered an honor to go there in honor of General Gordon. It was specifically because he had given his life for the Sudanese people. In fact, when the British government ordered him, "You must leave," he said, "Abandon the Sudanese people if you wish, but allow me the privilege of dying with them." And the government knew And they said, he's blackmailing us. He's going to die, and thereby force Britain to go back there to reestablish British honor and avenge his death. And then we're going to be saddled with Sudan. So Britain didn't want Sudan. I mean, who wanted Sudan? The only thing Sudan had to offer was slaves and ivory, which the British weren't interested in anyway because it was against their national policy. So that went there only in order to, which is why when Britain started decolonization, Sudan was like the first place they got rid of. They didn't want it. Yes. I don't think they could spell honor anymore. Nowhere was the departure of the colonial power regretted more deeply than in Gordon's Equatoria. And this is a monument set up in Khartoum overlooking the Nile of General Gordon with one of his favorite camels. And that's the way the people of Sudan recognize him. Just look at these magnificent roads, tree-lined, clean, neat. It's just hard to imagine that Khartoum was ever like that. And just to give you an idea of this monument, when after independence the statue of General Gordon was overturned, there was a howl of protest from the older residents of Khartoum. Gordon was a man of God. And so even Muslims respected Gordon. By the way, when General Gordon died on the palace steps, the Mahdi's forces, the dervishes, had him beheaded and carried his head on a pole to the Mahdi. And when the Mahdi saw this, he was actually so grief-stricken. He was sick, and he knew he's doomed. Because he knew, you kill Gordon, we're bringing the wrath of God and the British Empire upon us. And he tried everything he could. He sent out orders, no harm to be done to Gordon. And from that point, he is sick, and he died in 6 months. It probably was fear, because he realized his whole cause is now finished. And yet the Mahdi had hoped to take Cairo, Baghdad, Constantinople. That was his intention. And all he got was Khartoum. And with the death of Gordon, he felt cursed and finished, which is intriguing. Because his body had been desecrated in that way, when Lord Kitchener got there, being quite a brutal man, very brutal man, as South Africa well knows, because he was the one who did the concentration camp, scorched earth campaigns in South Africa, he went to the Mahdi's tomb and desecrated the Mahdi's tomb and scattered his bones and all that and basically showed contempt. Now, I don't think that's the way Christians should behave. You know, this tit for tat at all. But that's Lord Kitchener was that kind of low type of individual. Gordon would never have done that. He wouldn't have approved it. But his idea was, you dare to desecrate the body of a British general, we're going to desecrate your holy prophet's body. And so he did that. But, I mean, that's typical Kitchener. He had no government authority for that. And I think it does not speak well of us when we lower ourselves to the standard of the enemy.
But he was not a Christian, Lord Kitchener.
Well, not the kind of Christian we'd understand. If he was, he might have gone to church, but there's no evidence he had any personal faith. Everyone knew General Gordon was a God-fearing, Bible-believing, evangelical believer who was evangelistic. Nobody would have ever said that about Kitchener. I mean, Kitchener, if he had a religion, it was not evident. You know, he might have gone to church, but that was it. As with any great man, General Gordon has received some vicious criticism from detractors who hate what he stood for, and so they choose to assail his character. Some have depicted him as a drunkard, and sadly, that was done even in the film Khartoum with Charlton Heston. He's endlessly swilling the liquor there, but no one ever saw him drunk. He did drink on occasion, but never in the field, never on safari, as he put it. He is reportedly never immoderate in his consumption of alcohol. He gave up alcohol regularly. Nobody ever saw him drunk. So this business that he's always, you know, where's my bourbon and soda and all, I mean, that's just myth. It's extremely improbable that he could have been a habitual drinker. At the cracking pace he worked, with as little sleep as he had, in the harsh climates he traveled, with as many enemies he had, neither his health, nor his work, nor his reputation in Sudan could have endured it. No one in Sudan to this day respects a man who's a drunkard. No one. In fact, they don't even respect you if you take a drop of alcohol. Just another reason why I'd never touch alcohol, never have, and not interested. But the fact is, in any place in Africa, if you drink, they call you a drunkard. Others have attempted to portray him as a homosexual. Now, They've even tried to take people like, they made a big Hollywood movie, one of the most expensive movies ever made, which was Alexander, which is trying to depict Alexander the Great as a homosexual. But Alexander the Great was married, had children. I mean, where did he get this homosexual business? Well, homosexuals are trying to take great men and make some kind of respect for their own cause by... Now, what's the evidence that he was a homosexual? He didn't get married. Okay. But there's a lot of soldiers and generals in the 19th century who duty honor country, they're away from home so much, and they didn't get married because they were so duty orientated. That's no proof that they're homosexuals. You take his monument here. Notice what is he depicted with? It's plainly a Bible. See the cross? There's the cross on it. He's got the Bible. This is the way his contemporaries depict him. A God-fearing man with the word of God in his hand. The fact that Gordon never married and that he devoted much of his time to rescuing orphaned boys from the streets is hardly evidence of homosexuality. But on this flimsy basis, there's been some speculation. Yet Gordon was a strict Victorian Christian gentleman. He wrote scathingly against the effeminate. He was appalled by the reprehensible sin of Sodom, as you can read in his books, and Gomorrah. Again, with all the many enemies he had, it's remarkable that not once in his 51 years did any one of his contemporaries suggest the slightest bit of scandal, aside from the fact that he had a great disdain for money. I mean, that's the only scandal, really. One criticism which is true is Gordon had a fiery temper. He did not tolerate incompetence, indolence, or dishonesty. He had people flogged for lying. He was a tiresome perfectionist. Yet, he was as quick to wound, so he is quick to apologize. He never lost his power to compel love, fear, and obedience from those around him. And again, remember, this is the 19th century. Victorian Christians, this is the way they operated. He had his faults, but there's no doubt he was a devout and sincere Christian, a courageous soldier, a compassionate leader who cared for the poor and the helpless. And his legacy is seen in Equatoria, where Christian soldiers still strive to follow his courageous example by fighting for faith and freedom. There he's affectionately remembered as Gordon Pasha. Remember my first chaplain's parade in Maridi, in the army base in Maridi, battalion parade, and I spoke about General Charles Gordon. There was a bit of confusion. My interpreter was talking with me, and then suddenly said, "Ah, Gordon Pasha!" And the entire battalion, "Gordon Pasha!" And it was this excitement because they knew him as Gordon Pasha. And I was using the English term General Charles Gordon, which isn't the way they refer to him. Once identified, there was just this wide beams, bright ivory teeth and black faces, bright eyes, and the people were so excited to remember Gordon Pasha. He is honored in many places. His family is a great family, and this is, for example, Robert Gordon College, one of his relatives. And this plaque commemorates the centenary of the death of General Charles Gordon at Khartoum on 26 January 1885, and marks the site of Fort House, in which he lived as commanding Royal Engineer from 1865 to 1871. His task at Gravesend was to supervise the remodeling of the Thames defences, but he is better known for his devotion to the poor and the sick of the town. This is at Gravesham Borough Council on the 26th of January, 1985. Here's one of his memorials in Britain. At the base it says, "Major General Charles George Gordon, Royal Engineers, soldier, administrator, philanthropist. Born at Woolwich, January 28th, 1833, slain at Khartoum, January 26th, 1885. Just 2 days short of his 52nd birthday. His last letter to his sister ended with these words, "I'm quite happy, thank God, I tried to do my duty." And here's another memorial, General Charles Gordon. This statue is dedicated to the memory of General Gordon, who so faithfully served the poor of this borough between the years 1865 to 1871. Together with his modernization of New Tavern Fort and other forts along the Thames, he is best remembered for his generosity and his struggle to give the benefits of education to the poor of this town. General Gordon was murdered during the siege of Khartoum and departed this life 26 January 1885. A towering figure and a towering monument. And this is what I've seen along the Thames. I took this picture in London, obviously in winter. And interestingly enough, you will also get the same statue in Victoria. This is Victoria in Australia, as in, you know, the province of Victoria, and in Melbourne, in Collins Street. And again, the Australians remember him with great affection. As you can see, that is not London, palm trees and all that. At St. Paul's Cathedral, which is the parish church of London, at the highest point in London. By the way, this is believed by many in Britain to be where St. Paul preached the gospel upon landing on the British Isles. That's why it's called St. Paul's. It's also the highest point in London. It's the parish church, burned in the fire of 1666, rebuilt by Sir Christopher Wren. Magnificent church. Absolutely, staggeringly magnificent church. This is where, for example, Charles and Diana were married. This is where Margaret Thatcher was buried and so on, or had a funeral service, I should say. Well, in it, there is an enclave for the remains of General Charles Gordon. And as you can see, I took this picture. You can see Gordon written on the side, on the floor. And this is what it says in this. Major General Charles George Gordon, who at all times and everywhere gave his strength to the weak, his substance to the poor, his sympathy to the suffering, his heart to God. Born at Woolwich, slain in Khartoum, he saved an empire by his warlike genius. He ruled vast provinces with justice, wisdom, and power. And lastly, obedient to his sovereign's command, he died in a heroic attempt to save men, women, and children from imminent and deadly peril. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. This monument is erected by his only surviving brother, whose eldest son also perished in the service of his country as a midshipman in HMS Captain, and is commemorated with others in adjoining recess. Now, notice it says, obedient to his sovereign's command. Now, he was disobedient to his government. The Prime Minister had expressly forbidden him to do what he was doing. But he knew that he had the support of the Queen. And he swore allegiance to the Queen, not to the blasted Prime Minister or the people in Parliament. So they've chose these words very carefully. Queen Victoria supported what he's doing. She is an evangelical born-again queen. She is a missionary-minded queen. And she really liked him. He was Queen Victoria's favorite general, without a doubt. So the wording here, obedient to his sovereign's command, while he was in complete disobedience to his government's command. He died in the heroic attempt to save men, women, and children from imminent deadly peril. Very well put together, very thoughtful, but notice his the monument includes his hand is on the Bible, on a well-worn Bible. Very appropriate. Psalm 68, verse 31 is a psalm that I'm sure many times came to his mind. Cush will submit herself to God, the people of Cush, the land of Sudan. And so you see, today our mission is still working in Sudan. We're working in a Sudan which was opened up for the gospel in many ways by General Gordon, and whose heroic death and life inspired General Dr. Reverend Kenneth Fraser to go and plant the first hospital, the first school, and the first church in Louis, in Moreland. And I was later called to Moreland to minister in Mundry and Louis, Cotterby, all these areas. In fact, we just heard this week that on Monday, Canon Kenneth Beringer, the man who gave me the Macedonian call, you must come to Moreland, died in Juba, and he is being transported to be buried in Christ's Cathedral in Mundry this very weekend. But Kenneth Beringer went through enormous amount of the early years of our mission in Sudan. He's the one who tracked me down. He's the one who wrote to me. He'd heard about my work in Mozambique, Angola, knew that we needed to come to Sudan. And on an East African mission when I just returned from Rwanda, he tracked me down in Nairobi, Kenya, and came, and he, with intensity of a message, called, you must come to Moreland. And Kenneth Beringer was with me on our first missions to Sudan. We walked hundreds of kilometers together. We were bombed together, we were shelled together, we came under artillery bombardment, we came under aerial bombardment together. He was a real, true friend, our best friend, incidentally. I remember many a time we preached on this very verse and spoke about General Gordon and General Kenneth Fraser, after whom he is named. Kenneth Berengra, named after Kenneth Fraser, the first missionary to Equatoria, to their people in Moreland. So this is why we are working in Sudan. And interesting, the connection between Cape Town and Khartoum, between our Lord Jesus Christ and the Commandant General of the Castle of Good Hope in Cape Town, who identified for the world the tomb and the site of Golgotha. And the link, it's just extraordinary. Even here, this picture that you get on our Frontline website is of the Nuba Mountains, where the Mahdi fought his great battles against Colonel Hicks and all the rest of it. And this is so much part of our work. You can see why we're interested in General Gordon. I've given a whole chapter in Faith and Defiance Sudan to General Gordon and Mahdi. So the text of the whole presentation is all in Faith and Defiance Sudan under that particular chapter. So any questions, any comments? Reflections in Palestine. That's a good challenge. We need to track that book down. We need to get that book. No, I do not have a copy. I'd love to have a copy. At Reflections in Palestine. Yes. Let's make that a task for Nick to track down for CLB and for our library. It's quite extraordinary that Cape Town, the utmost part of the earth, has got connections with such momentous events, places far and wide. Yes.
On that subject, I'm just curious, this is interesting, about the connection between Cape Town and how it's contributing to the history.
Yes, okay. So, in 1810, William Carey, the father of modern missions, proposed a world missions conference, and he recommended Cape Town. Now, he'd only been Cape Town once, on his way from England out to India, 6-month journey by sea. He stopped at Cape Town, looked at Table Mountain. He said, when he proposed in 1810, now he went out the mission field in 1793, but in 1810 he said, we need a world missions conference, and the best location would be Cape Town, at the uttermost part of Earth, at the gateway between East and West, the only city, well, just actually not a city, it's a town. It's not Cape City, it's called Cape Town after all. Only town that is astride two oceans, the warm Indian Ocean, the cold Atlantic. Cape of Storms, now called the Cape of Good Hope. Uttermost parts of Earth, let's have a world missions conference in Cape Town. He is a century ahead of his time. The first world missions conference was held 100 years later in Edinburgh in 1910. And the first world missions conference in Cape Town was held in 2010. And I was a participant there. And nobody at the conference seemed to have known about the Edinburgh conference of 1910. Was it just coincidence? They never mentioned it from top. Not 4,300 people. I said, surely this is... Nobody had even heard of the Edinburgh Conference 1810, even the organizers. I said, how could this be a coincidence? Anyway, and 200 years to the date of when William Carey had proposed the World Missions Conference, which is also surprising for everyone, which is also intriguing because at 2010 Cape Town Conference, where we had 4,300 representatives from 197 countries of the world, we launched the latest edition of Operation World, which is 1,000-page doorstopper on every country in the world. And in that book, they identify William Carey and as an inquiring the obligation of Christians to use means for the conversion of the heathen was the first Operation World, which surveyed the world missionary-wise in guidance for both intercession and action. And in fact, fortunately, Operation World identified. So when they launched the latest edition Cape Town 2010, they acknowledged William Carey was the inspiration for the first book inquiry, which has led to Operation World, which is a modern phenomenon. And our mission was launched into Mozambique because of praying through Operation World in the army and seeing Mozambique was the least evangelized country in the Southern Hemisphere, not one Bible for 1,000 people, no missionaries allowed, no one under 18 allowed in church and so on, no baptisms under 18. And I read about Mozambique in Op World. That's when the call gripped my heart, and our mission really was launched in the direction of Mozambique. So there's connections with William Carey and World Missions and Cape Town. Any other questions, comments, observations?
You've probably watched the video cartoon. How
many a time? Well worth watching. Very interesting. Very inspiring. I love it. In fact, I've taken it to Sudan and I've shown it to people there. And interestingly enough, when I showed that film, I'd just earlier before shown them the Ben-Hur film. Yeah, six. We did a lot of G's film, but this is in some places, so I'd bring in some other films. And somebody came to me and said, it seems to me that Ben-Hur is Gordon Pasha. I said, that's very observant of you. Actually, it's an actor, Charlton Heston, who played both. Now this guy's completely confused. Now, but Ben-Hur was 2,000 years ago, and Gordon Pasha was 100 years ago. I said, yeah. I mean, you can imagine, for some of the people, the first film they ever saw was the Jesus film. So this is really funny. But anyway, so what I did, this is days of videos, videotapes. So I had to cut out two scenes, and I had to add another, because Khartoum is well made. What I didn't appreciate was that regularly it was him swilling brandy and where's my whiskey and soda or whatever it was that he ordered, I forget. But he ordered some drinks regularly. And that is just like myth. No. Then there's another scene in which his Muslim servant in Khartoum, someone he had rescued from slavery, actually, asked him about, you know, but Jesus says in the Bible, if somebody hits into one cheek, you turn the other. But you don't turn the other cheek. You know, you use your sword and your revolver and so on. And Gordon, as depicted by Charlton Heston, kind of doesn't answer the question, says, I need you to go and take this message to the Mahdi and so on. So he never answered the question, which it's impossible to believe from everything I've read of General Gordon that he wouldn't have answered a simple Bible ethical question like that. And of course, he is a Bible student. He would have had answers. The worst thing, which I really had to take the scissors to and cut out the film, is when he's hired by the Khedive of Egypt, the Khedive has some of these dancing girls dancing around, belly dancers, you know, all these whatever nonsense, and he sat there and tolerated it while being interviewed by the Khedive, whereas he wouldn't. He is known to stand up and walk out if anyone did that. He wouldn't tolerate immoral dancing and things like this. So I just chopped those out. So aside from that, though, it was accurate and good, so much so that I'd show the film. But, I mean, those parts were, why did Hollywood slip that in? All told, it wasn't even 4 minutes worth taken up, probably less than 3 minutes. But anyway, but I cut those out. But then I didn't want to end the film on a defeat. I mean, I'm showing this to the Sudanese while in the middle of a battle. So what I then did was I took from young Winston, which has got just a, it's a short section, but it's a massive set piece battle, the Battle of Omdurman, which is the revenge when Lord Kitchener's army comes up and Omdurman just annihilates the Mahdi's armies. And so what we did is, instead of the film ending with the death of Gordon, we went on to the Battle of Omdurman, where the British came back and flattened the Arabs. And of course, that ended the film with lots of cheers and excitement. And yeah. I kind of tampered with the film, but I thought it made a lot better. And so we showed that. But these poor guys were really, really confused as to how Gordon Pasha could have also been Ben-Hur. Yeah. I'm sure we got in our library, and it's well worth watching. The great thing with DVD is you can skip the little bit of the interview with the Governor's Palace, which is, why on earth did it put junk like that in? And Charlton Heston's a good man. Charlton Heston is a Bible-believing Christian, good chap who really, really stood up against nonsense in Hollywood. And that's why Hollywood hated him in last years, because he was just such a principled conservative Christian. But that was early in his life, maybe. But 1966 film, Khartoum. Well worth watching. But just how they managed to show the... Although it was just the last few months of his life, but you get the referring back, and you can kind of see, like, he goes to this one man, Suleiman, how, and he goes to Suleiman to try and get him to help him with fighting the Mahdi. And Shaf said, you had my son shot. Mm. Well, he was a slave trader. But instead of Gordon giving a straight answer like that, he just says, God forgive me. Which he might have said, but again, it's hard to believe he wouldn't have reminded him, your son Suleiman enslaved and murdered how many different people? Yes, I had him shot for good reason, but again, he doesn't defend what's done there. So I'd say my complaints against the film would be 5%, but about 95% of the film's good. Well worth seeing. Anyway, the Charlton Heston, one of his best roles. Personally, I think he just nailed General Gordon well if they just left out this whiskey and soda rubbish. Right, any other questions, comments?
I think it's an incredible man. I mean, just think of what he achieved.
Yes. There's one observation I haven't mentioned. As somebody says, he's a British general who never commanded British troops. He commanded Chinese troops. He commanded Egyptian troops. He commanded Sudanese troops. He commanded Cape troops, not British Imperial troops as such, because the ones in the castle, actually, there was very few British troops there. He never had a British army at his disposal. He fought with foreign troops everywhere he went. And another thing that I didn't mention, which comes in my presentation, Henry Morton Stanley, is when Henry Morton Stanley finished his 5 years of civilizing, governing the Congo, and he went back to Europe, he had asked General Gordon to be a successor, to be the next governor of the Free State of Congo. And Gordon was on his way to do that when the British government intervened and said, will you go to Khartoum? And he said, but I am not a free agent. I'm really committed to the King of Belgium for the Congo. And his friend, Henry Morton Stanley, had requested him to do this, to fight the slave trade in Congo and so on. And the British government said, we've already spoken to the King of the Belgians, and he's withdrawn the obligation from you so that you're free to follow your government's wishes. So he went. Obviously, if he'd gone to Congo, he would have lived longer. It's interesting that there he even ties in with Henry Morton Stanley, which is another larger-than-life, incredible character of the 19th century.
When did the slave trade end formally in Congo? Because Belgium was doing the
1960s. Now, that's total, utter garbage. The slave trade in the Congo was crushed by Henry Morton Stanley. When he is called the breaker of rocks, he was the one who achieved it. But to keep the slave trade finished, he was after Gordon to continue. So the Belgians came in and destroyed the slave trade. Now, because Vladimir Lenin and Karl Marx have propagated the fiction that the European nations came to Africa to enslave the people, which is actually the opposite of the truth. They came to Africa to end the slave trade on every single case, whether you're talking about the French, the Belgians, the Portuguese, the British, the Dutch, all came to Africa to end the slave trade. But now the liberators like Mugabe and Kwame Nkrumah and so on, they were portraying themselves as the liberators. So they didn't want to acknowledge that anything good had come from the colonials. So they were claiming that the colonials were enslaving the people, which isn't true. Exactly. So in his lifetime, King Leopold was hailed as the greatest humanitarian on earth. And he was given awards from all over. And he had a Bible-believing evangelical Christian, Henry Morton Stanley, leading the charge in freeing the Congo of slavery, ending intertribal genocide, ending the slave trade, all of the rest. And the people in his lifetime hailed Leopold as the most principled, sacrificial man. He bankrupted himself because his government wasn't interested. He poured everything into the Congo Free State. And the Congo Free State was being freed from, the Congo was the heart of darkness. It's inspired the novel, A Heart of Darkness. It was cannibalism, slave trade, intertribal genocide. It was the worst place on earth. That's what everyone said back in the 1800s. He turned it into a place where everyone was safe, peace, and incredible achievements of Henry Morton Stanley in just a matter of 5 years. Well, King Leopold put his personal fortune because his government wasn't willing to take it on. The British didn't want the Congo. No one wanted the Congo, not the French, not the Germans. The Congo was like, you've got to be kidding. They will chop your head off and eat you. It's not the place anyone wanted to go. And so Leopold bankrupted himself, put his personal fortune into the Congo Free State, and was hailed as a great humanitarian. In my lifetime, since 1960, Leopold has turned into the worst mass murdering, genocidal, slave trading lunatic who oppressed and slaughtered and killed tens of millions of Congolese and chopped off their hands and feet for not making enough rubber. And all of this is the propaganda that came out of the Soviets and the Patrice Lumumba lunatics who were sacrificing missionaries and murdering Christians in the 1960s. And so they had to rewrite history, just like Mugabe and the Mbeki crowds have had to rewrite history here to make themselves liberators and heroes. So the Congolese, which have got to have had some of the worst kleptomaniac thieves on the planet, like Mobutu Seseku, who was the fourth richest man in the world when his country was the fifth poorest country in the world, was, you know, just a kleptomaniac pariah. The only thing they had going for them was anti-colonialism. And so the stories kept growing. And King Leopold, instead of being the world's number one humanitarian who ended the slave trade and freed the people of the Congo, became the person who brought slavery to the Congo. This is Marxist propaganda. It's not true. And now I've been to the Congo, ministered there, and the people in the Congo have told me, we were safe under the Belgians. You could drive from one side of the Congo to the other in 3 or 4 days in a normal car, no four-wheel drives needed. Now you couldn't get across with a four-wheel drive in 4 months. The chaos and the violence, and millions have been slaughtered in the Great Lakes Wars and so on in the Congo. And what's gone on there is just a nightmare, and it's gone back to the heart of darkness in some places. So the people who want to make out that Leopold was the worst, I've seen like King Leopold's ghost, and it's just pathetic. And I'm afraid the latest Tarzan film adds to that. They've made it out that the cannibals are the good guys and the Belgian colonials are the real evil ones. Literally. I mean, anyone seen the recent Tarzan? Not worth watching. What a waste of time. What a piece of garbage. But this is part of the propaganda. I've seen it even in my lifetime. I've seen how King Leopold's gone from being humanitarian hero who freed the slaves to being genocidal maniac who enslaved the people of Congo. It's, if I've got to choose between the contemporaries of that time, you know, people like Henry Morton Stanley and Livingston's accounts and what the people today are saying, it's no contest. I mean, I don't trust the pathological liars writing our history books today. Yes?
Do you maybe know why we get the Congo and the DRC Congo?
Okay, there are two Congos. Because there's a Congo River, there's the Belgian Congo, which is on the southern side of the Congo River. And to distinguish it from the French Congo, the French government took what they call Congo. So there's Congo Brazzaville, that's north of the Congo River, and there's Congo Kinshasa, which is south of the Congo River. So effectively speaking, there's two Congos. To distinguish between them, they used to say French Congo and Belgian Congo. I grew up with French and Belgian Congo in my mind. Now it was Congo Brazzaville, Congo Kinshasa, which then the kleptomaniac Mobutu Seseku renamed Zaire, because the name Congo had become such a bad word that people just thought of, you know, when people mentioned Congo, you thought nuns being raped, missionaries being murdered, massacres, slaughters, Simba. Patrice Lumumba turned it into a hellhole, and so they changed the name to Zaire. Well, after a while, Zaire became a byword for corruption and all the rest of it. So then they changed the name back to Congo, but now they call it Democratic Republic of Congo. And whenever you hear the word democratic, you know it's not. I mean, anything like, you know, or take the People's Liberation Army. There's no, as somebody said, if you've got to put the word United into a country's name, it probably isn't. Like United Arab Emirates, United Kingdom, United States, United Nations. And then democratic, you see the word democratic in all sorts of names of the worst dictatorships on the planet, like North Korea and China. So I speak about Red China and, you know, the Congo. I'm not going to speak about the Democratic Republic of the Congo, honestly. And when I grew up, DRC meant Dutch Reformed Church. Anyway, I just refuse to play the game. So if they want to, it's like when people say the Prophet Muhammad. I don't believe he's a prophet. False prophet maybe, but he's not a real prophet. So I'll just say Muhammad. I'm not going to say Prophet Muhammad. And I'm not going to say Democratic Republic of Congo either, except as a joke, maybe. Okay, any other comments? Well, so General Gordon's definitely one of the victorious Christians, one of the heroes of the faith. And I believe this is a key thing of what we do in the Reformation Society is examples of excellence from different parts of history. I think the best way to learn history, as with economics, is by examples. So I believe the Harvard Law School, they take case studies of law. And economics, they'll do examples of economic models that work or don't work. And so I think in Christian history, you look at great examples of excellence. Occasionally, you look at bad examples of bad people, what not to do. You know, the Mugabes and Mao's and Marx's and Lenin's of this world. You can learn from bad examples too, but most of our emphasis is on excellent examples. And General Gordon just stands out as the Victorian Christian general that just puts everyone else in the shade in the 19th century.
One final question.
Well, when we say, no, I don't mean it's an organizationally united front. But, you know, when we speak of, for example, secular humanism, it's not like there's one group who's defining secular humanism and coordinating and controlling the views of all humanists. Just like there's not, well, except in the spiritual realm, there's not one united Christian front where all Christians are following specific orders. Now, it would be nice if we were all listening to God through the Holy Spirit and following his orchestration, but evidently that's not happening, generally speaking. Most Christians are way off the path and so on. So, but all the same, Christians through the ages in different languages and cultures and areas around the world, we are inspired by a common Bible, which some have read, others have not. Some have read parts of and some misunderstand parts. But the fact is, we have a common general worldview and ethos. Not always consistent, but I can go across the world and meet a Christian in the Nuba Mountains, and we've got a lot in common instantly. Might be a different language, culture, race, all that. Might even use different calendar, but the fact is, because of our Christian faith, there's commonality, and we'll work together. That's why some white South African Rhodesian could end up helping the Sudanese fight for independence instead, because we've got a lot in common because we're Christians. Now, in the same way, a secular humanist will naturally gravitate to other secular humanists. That doesn't mean there's a conspiracy, always. In many cases, just a humanist identifies with another humanist, and therefore he's pro-abortion, evolution, billions of years, climate change, global warming, the whole deal. Now, he's probably bought a whole package of things, including legalized abortion and things like that, and he thinks that's good. Now, it's not necessarily a conspiracy, it's just as whether he's a journalist or a professor in a university, he's, because of his worldview, upbringing, or his orientation, he will tend to move in that direction. Similarly with a Muslim, and so on. Although, today, I had an interview on a Muslim radio station, not because Muslims and Christians have that much in common, but we both oppose abortion. And so, there they were happy for me to be giving a report back in March, because we do agree with, so, on a university campus, and I'm fighting an atheist or an evolutionist or a communist, Muslims will often suddenly, I'll find them on my side supporting my argument, and I might be supporting theirs, because when it comes to communism and atheism, evolutionism and abortion, pornography and blasphemy, Muslims are closer to us than are to them. And so, it's not that all communists are necessarily working consciously together, but they have an orientation that moves them in certain directions. So that a North Korean communist and a Chinese communist, they may have differences, but they've got more in common with one another than with capitalist South Korea, for example. The Koreans should be closer but ideologically they separate between free Christian South Korea and atheist communist North Korea. Now, again, you go all the way over to California and you'll find some communist or humanist or atheist or evolutionist professor, and he will somehow identify far more with a communist in China than he will with a Christian in California. We had this down here. Anyone heard of Rich Christians and Age of Hunger? Ronald Sider. Ronald Sider was speaking at a Bible college. In fact, a series, all the Bible colleges in Cape Town came together to hear this Christian socialist, Ronald Sider, speaking at the AME, I think African Methodist Episcopal in Athlone. So Sean and I went there. And there's this character, Ronald Sider, and he's just giving us Christian socialism. I mean, it's obnoxious. But there's a lot of amens out there. So Sean and I, knowing we're in an audience that doesn't fully see through him, we ask questions to try and bring him out. So I think Sean might have asked this question. Where do you stand as far as prayer in schools go? He says, oh, I believe children should be allowed to pray. Just not in school. There's a lot of nodding. But what's he just said? He said, he didn't say I don't believe in prayer in schools, but he's effectively said, I believe children should be allowed to pray, but not in school. Instead of saying, no, I don't believe Christians should be allowed to pray in school, he put it in such a way that the average Christian thought, oh, believes in prayer. And then it came with a whole lot of other things. For example, when it came to abortion, most people had missed the fact that he had said, we need to follow China's one-child policy. Ronald Sider, evangelical, so-called, to this group of Bible colleges in Cape Town, we need to, in view of overpopulation, we need to follow China's one-child policy. And there's a lot of nodding heads and amens. Now, what does China's one-child policy mean? Sterilizations and forcible abortions, or even infanticide, once you've passed your one child. Okay, hands up anyone who's not the first born in their family. I mean, I'm fourth. Yeah, okay. Well, none of us should be here according to the one-child policy. Right, exactly. Because only the first child's allowed. Everyone else is, you know, aborted, sterilized, infanticized, or drowned in a bucket of water. That's China's one-child policy. And this evil, secular humanist masquerading as a Christian managed to get a whole bunch of Bible college students and lecturers to nod and agree we need to follow China's one-child policy. He was pushing every single secular humanist gender. From socialism, pro-Marxist, pro-communist, pro-ANC, the whole lot. And we're talking about back in, this is back in early 1990s, before the changeover in 94. He was pushing everything on the agenda. Now, Ronald Sider is technically a Christian, but practically he's a secular humanist. And the whole book, Productive Christians and Age of Guilt Manipulators, was written by David Chilton to counter Ronald Sider's Rich Christians, Age of Hunger, which is an insidious undermining of Christian principles and biblical worldview. So, yes. Now, this doesn't mean there's a conspiracy. It doesn't mean he got his orders. This is what you got to say. But the films you watch, the education you receive, the books you read, the family upbringing you get, the choices you make, all tend to make you more on the line of whether you're going to be an Islamic jihadist, a secular humanist, a Marxist revolutionary, a even jellyfish, or a Bible-believing fundamentalist, or a reformed, missionary-minded Christian activist. And so there's ranges of things, but in the wide spectrum of the world, you've got a whole lot of people who are communist, but they're different orientations of it. But if it comes down to a fight, they're going to pick a fellow communist, even if he's a slightly different type of communist or a radically different communist, over a Christian. Just like I find myself standing up with Orthodox Christians, Catholic Christians even in some cases, because they're fighting against Islam or they're being persecuted for their faith by communists. And so I'll find myself, while in a Reformation society and Protestant movement, I'm often speaking against Catholicism. But in the field, I've often found myself helping Catholics because they're the closest to my position. And they're being persecuted because of the name of Christ. So I've had Christians in New Mountain saying to me, but you're a Protestant. Why you bring Bibles to us? And I said, if I can bring Bibles to Catholics without getting burned at the stake, I count myself privileged. Mm-hmm. And I'm very happy to bring you Bibles. And they said, you know, our priests don't come to us. We don't get visits from the Catholics from Europe, but you're a Protestant. You're visiting our church. And I said, well, I come because of the Great Commission of our Lord Jesus Christ. And you know, some Catholics being surprised, why would I be coming there? Well, I'd give Bibles to Muslims and communists too. Why would I not give them to Catholics? So, and sometimes I find myself standing up and defending the Catholics because of the ideological. So you see, it's not necessarily a conspiracy. It's got a lot to do with the worldview.
But also a lot of time, for instance, in Lugo Mountain, there's a Catholic school, but they believe the same, like the Protestant and the Catholic church is the same place where they get trained. Where we work. So there's just a Catholic church because of the name. They're not...
But you know why that is? Because 20 years ago they were given Bibles, and now they've been reading Bibles, and they haven't been having Catholic indoctrination, so they've become more Protestant. So, in fact, you can praise God for the Bibles getting to people who otherwise would be pretty cultic. When I was first converted, we regarded Seventh-day Adventists as a cult. And you know, there's a lot of Seventh-day Adventists today who are more evangelical and Bible-believing than a lot of so-called evangelicals. Why? Well, they've been reading more of their Bibles, and I find there's a lot of Seventh-day Adventists more Bible-believing than your average Anglican now. So, you know, we didn't regard Anglicans as a cult when I was converted. But now a lot of Anglican churches look like it when they're having homosexual marriages and gay priests, and they're like, oh. So, you know, at this point, suddenly the Mormons don't look that bad compared to... So things do move, but what shouldn't move is our loyalty to the Bible, and that's what's got to decide our relationships. But as missionaries, we're not picky. So I've had some people criticize, how could you go to... You know, you've spoken at Jehovah's Witness Church and... Yeah, I've spoken Mormon temples and I've spoken Catholic schools and churches too. But we're missionaries. I'd speak in a mosque if I could. In fact, I have spoken in some mosques. I've spoken in communist places. So as a missionary, we take every invitation. I'm not concerned about are these people on my wavelength, because as a missionary, we go to people diametrically opposed to us. If I got a chance to preach to communist cannibals, I'd do it. It's not an endorsement of them. A missionary goes to anyone because that's our mandate.
I'm curious how you managed to get invited to the mosque.
No, I didn't exactly get invited to the mosque. I went to the mosque. And I've done this in several times, and I go to the imam. First time was in Swaziland, and I went to the mosque, and I said, I'm a theological student, and I'm interested in studying Islam. All excited, gathered around, and we had I had 3 days in my schedule. I was waiting for visas to come through from Mozambique, and I was sitting in Isilweni Mosque, Islamic Propagation Center National, while the imam was teaching Islam. And first day, I just listened and only asked questions to clarify points. And second day, I was asking more probing. By third day, I was getting very seriously into questions, hard questions. And then he said, would you like a debate? So he organized a public debate in the mosque. And I think he regretted it later because I knew more about Islam than I'd let on. But at that point, we had a full-on debate in the mosque. I mean, in the mosque, Christian, Muslim. So. And so we've done this in the Islamic Propagation Center in Durban, the biggest mosque in the Southern Hemisphere in Durban. I've done debates with Muslims in different places. And so it's not like they invited me. It's more like they thought, here's some dumb Christian we can embarrass and humiliate. And then they challenged me to debate. And I act like I'm being suckered into it. And then we pull out our best arguments and napalm the floor, you know. So I got into communist terrorist camps by saying, would you like to see a film? These guys are bored out of their mind. Sure. Crank up the Jesus film, showed them Jesus film. They're like, wow. And I went someplace, said, I've got a film on the world's greatest revolutionary. Are you interested? And then I'd say, you know, I'd speak about Marx and Engels, and said, but all their revolutions failed. But I'm going to show you a film about the world's greatest revolutionary, whose revolution continued. He was... born third-class subject in a oppressed nation under the Roman Empire, how he fought for freedom and liberation, the real liberation, freedom of the heart, and what his revolution continues to this day. And these guys, oh, you know, tell us about this revolutionary, and then showed the cheese film. So there's different angles you can take at different times. I've got the tract out there called The World's Greatest Revolutionary, which was basically that message I'd give to communists on, you know, your revolutionary is all failures. The revolutionary is Jesus. He's the greatest revolutionary of all time. Yeah, the only revolution that really works. And anyway, but, well, okay. Any other comments, questions? Let's pray for Sudan. Let's turn that off. I think praying for Sudan in particular, but We need soldiers like this. May God raise up people like General Gordon who won't get their marching orders just from the world, but from the Lord.